Welcome to the Power Hour. I'm Adrienne Herbert, wellness coach, international speaker, and author. Each week, I speak to a variety of guests, from business founders to Olympic athletes, leading coaches, change makers, and innovators, to find out their daily habits, their rules to live by, and what motivates them to get up out of bed each day. Personally, I am on a mission to encourage, motivate, and inspire, so I hope that the Power Hour will help you to achieve your personal and professional goals. Welcome back to the Power Hour podcast. So a few weeks ago, I was working in France and I was delivering a presentation about well-being for the modern world. And so I shared a short episode whilst I was in France on this podcast, talking about my presentation, about the things that people were resonating with and the things that people had the most questions about at the end of my presentation. Now, of course, well-being for the modern world is a big topic. It covers the physical, physiological health, mental and emotional health, our social and environmental, our spiritual health, our spiritual well-being, relationships, movement, sleep, diet. This is big, you know, there's lots of things encompassed here. Now, the modern world part was the interesting part because I was talking about what things are influencing us and our physiology, our ability to sleep, our diets, our lifestyles, so things like stress. And I was talking about the nervous system and this idea of upregulating your nervous system. So when you want to feel more alert, more awake, focused, ready to respond, to act, to take action, and downregulating the nervous system. So when you want to feel calmer, when your body is in a state where it can rest and digest and recover. And so that was something that I was talking about, this nervous system and how we can upregulate and downregulate. And for some people, they have heard about this before. And for others, they had never heard about this. And they kind of were like, wow, this is really interesting. And I want to learn more about it. Can this help me sleep? Can this help me to manage stress? Can this upregulating that you're talking about, can that give me more energy in the morning? Can that help me to have better mood because I'm, you know, if I have mood issues. So there were lots and lots of questions. Now, of course, on this podcast, I love to encourage people to take action in their own lives, to feel empowered, to learn more about their own bodies, to learn more about health, to learn more about how they can achieve their goals, build their businesses, improve their lives, improve their health, improve their relationships. And so with all that in mind, I thought I'm going to do better, longer, deeper dive on this topic. And so today I've invited Dr. Sula Windgassen, who is a health psychologist who I know talks about these topics online and delivers really, really great information about this. So I've invited Dr. Sula to talk to us today about these topics, about stress and chronic stress, about the connection between the mind and the body, or the separation, should I say, when it comes to health and well-being, and also to talk to us about, of course, what we can do, not just acknowledging these things and saying, okay, well, the modern world is challenging. It's challenging for our physiology. It's challenging for our mental health and our physical health. What can we do about it? You know, at the end of the year, before we go into another year, what can we do? What actions can we take? How can we think and take actions that are going to help us to optimize and to feel our best? So let's dive in to this week's episode. Dr. Sula, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm excited to chat.
Well, as I said, you know, there's so much in this topic, this idea of well-being for the modern world. Even the word well-being, I think, you know, people might hear that word and think of a yoga mat or a green juice or a candle. But we know that well-being is influenced and encompasses so many different things. It's our whole life. And so I think this idea of the separation between, you've got your physical body, you know, people train the body, go to the gym, exercise, movement, okay, full stop. And then it's almost like we turn the page and we think about mental health and mind and mood and these things. And it feels quite separate and quite divided. But what I really like about what you do, and I think that even being a health psychologist, I haven't really seen or heard this before. And what I really like about your work and what you do and the way you present it is the way you connect those two things. And so you explain, I suppose, the connection between the mind and the thoughts and the emotions and the feelings and things like stress and the physiological impact that it has on our bodies, on our digestion, on our skin, on our sleep, all of that. So where to begin? I think where I'd like to start, as I mentioned, I talked about the nervous system. So I'd love for you to talk to us about What do you think people need to know when it comes to the nervous system, this all of this topic I'm talking about, upregulating, downregulating? What do you think people need to firstly know and consider when it comes to understanding more about the nervous system?
Yeah, well, I guess first off, just defining what we mean by that, right? Which I guess is, you know, in its physical components, our brain, our spinal cord, and the network of nerves throughout our body that are communicating back and forth to the brain. And that's really the hardware that connects mind and body. So we can have sensory experiences that feed messages back up to the brain. And we have cognitive thought processes and emotional experiences that then message back down to the body. And it's a constant to or fro. So I suppose understanding that there is this physiological basis that means that mind and body are always communicating in so many different ways, you know, chemically, and whatever we do, whether that's a mental event, you know, thinking really hard about something, or whether that's a physical thing, doing some exercise, that's going to change our biochemistry and potentially change our whole homeostasis. So I guess I want to make the distinction, though, that because it's so vast and there's so many different influences in the nervous system and how it functions, we don't need to then get caught up in micromanaging everything, because that would just simply be an impossible task. But we can embrace the hope of it, which is there's so many potential avenues to create a positive influence. So we don't need to be like plugging loads of holes, but more like which instrument do we pick up to have a positive impact?
Yeah, and I think for us to give people a really clear and obvious example, I always think about public speaking. So I'm someone who does a lot of public speaking, and I've done it for such a long time and I've practiced it, so I feel like I get less nervous. I wouldn't say I don't feel nerves when I do public speaking, but I feel less nervous and I'm able to kind of, you know, control that, I suppose, physiological response and deliver my talk. But for some people, I know that public speaking is almost just a fear, a dread, and they feel like, you know, it's the worst thing ever. So I always say to people, if you imagine before you are about to present, so before you're about to walk onto a stage or give a speech at a wedding, something like that, people understand that if you're just sitting there in your chair and nothing's changed in your environment, you're not running around, you're not moving, but your heart rate might get, you know, it might increase. You might start to feel clammy hands and you might start to sweat, but the room's not getting warmer. The temperature hasn't changed. Nothing's changed. The only thing that has changed is your mind counting down and thinking, I'm going to stand up in a minute and talk to a room full of people, but your body responds. So if you can, and I think so many people have had that experience and they know what it feels like. So if you know that just by thinking about standing up and delivering a talk, your mouth gets dry, your hands get sweaty, your breathing gets faster, your pulse gets faster. If those physiological things can happen just through thinking about speaking, then I suppose my question to you is it, if it's a two-way street, is it, am I right in thinking that there's things you can do to the body that are going to affect the mind in exactly the same way? So something that you might do, like slowing down your breathing intentionally, for example, is that going to have an impact on the mind as well?
Yeah, absolutely. And the way that my treatment goes with people that I work with is we almost divide our process up into two streams. So the first stream is working with the body primarily in order to get more of an understanding about how the body is affected by what's going on emotionally in our minds, but also by just the things that we're doing. And then being able to exert influence from the body up to the mind. And this is really key, I think, to regulation, because it's so intuitive when we're feeling worried or activated to try and think our way out of it. And just, you know, that example that you gave, when you're in a room of people and you're starting to feel nervous about talking, you could talk yourself through that and be like, it's okay, nothing terrible can go wrong. And I'm sure loads of people have tried that in lots of different ways, but it doesn't really reduce that edge of what's going on physically, because you're communicating with your cognitive brain to a real base emotional evolutionarily hardwired system. And so to that end, what we really need to do is work with the body to be able to regulate, and then we can start using our thinking brains again. But the emotional brain and the nervous system kind of overrides that thinking brain when we're feeling you know, really dysregulated and activated and what have you. So it's really fundamental, I think, to be able to use your body first and foremost, and then we can start working with cognitive processes. But I don't think that's an intuitive human experience, because we're so used to using our brains to solve problems.
Yeah, absolutely. You're right. And that's the advice, isn't it, that we often get told, or we might give to other people, where we might say, you know, remember this, or remind yourself of a time when whatever. And you're right. So if that's the case, what are some of those physical things? So if someone is feeling the physiological effects of nerves, what are some things you can do to help the body to respond and to calm?
This is all going to sound truly, truly basic. And so one thing that I want to caveat, first of all, is that you're not trying to chase the feeling away. You know, you're still going to feel that adrenaline. Your palms are still going to be sweaty. You're still going to feel activated in some way. But if you relate to this more as, let me take the edge off the top so I've got a bit more control, that's what you're aiming for. Otherwise, you fall into the trap of, you know, let me really micromanage this whole entire experience, and then that creates its own problems. So if the aim is just to take that top edge off activation, the really basic first thing that is my go-to with everybody is regulating the breathing. So we know our in-breath and out-breath are related to our autonomic nervous system. So our in-breath is associated with that sympathetic nervous system, which is the fight or flight arm. And the out-breath is associated with the parasympathetic nervous system, which is the rest and digest. So when we're anxious, we're breathing quite shallowly, quite usually, and quite quickly. And so that's much more sympathetic nervous system activation. So we can change that just by creating deeper in-breath. So we're breathing all the way down into our lungs, filling up the lungs. And we've got these receptors at the bottom of our lungs that are activated when we fill our lungs right up with air, which then sends signals back to our brain to say, oh, we're safe, we're getting enough oxygen, which is one of the ways that our parasympathetic nervous system's activated, by taking nice deep breaths. And the other thing is, when we're exhaling, if we try and extend that out longer than the inhale, our out breath is associated with that parasympathetic nervous system activity. So this is like a really regulating thing on a physiological level to balance things out and calm things down a little bit. And just by doing that, you know, a few cycles over, you start to see that the body responds quite quickly. You're not having to micromanage that breath for the whole entire time that you're doing it. And that can just, you know, take that edge off. And the other thing that can go alongside that, and that you're doing just by virtue of connecting with your breath, is getting back into the body. So trying to move your attention from the flurry of thoughts about what could happen, you know, what all of these anxious symptoms mean, what's going to happen next, all of the catastrophes that your brain can easily go to when you're feeling anxious, and try and come back to physically ground yourself in the body. So those are two foundational basics that I would say to do to try and take that edge off straight away.
Yeah, really, really useful. Because as you said, people might think, oh, that's basic, breathe through your nose, out through your mouth, slow down your breathing. But when you actually try it, it's so different, isn't it? I often say to people, do it right now. You know, I'll just say to people, breathe in.
Yeah.
Fill your lungs, fill your belly with air. Really feel like what it feels like to do a deep breath. Might be the first time all day that you've actually taken a deep breath and then breathe out. Like, let it out. And even just doing that three times, it changes the way you feel. And the example that I just gave was, of course, I suppose, reasonable, rational. Okay, a lot of people might be fearful of public speaking, so therefore this is the response. However, as we know, sometimes anxiety, stress, adrenaline, cortisol, feeling that feeling of panic or distress isn't always related to something right there in the moment that we can think about. So some people, for example, might wake up in the morning and before they've even got out of bed, they might start to feel this feeling of panic, anxiety, and racing heart, cortisol, adrenaline. So in that instance, are these two tools and tactics still useful? Is it the same thing that you would suggest?
Yeah, definitely. And I suppose what can easily happen is that initial thing of having the physiological symptoms of panic or increased cortisol for whatever reason can then get that, you know, worried thinking brain involved, and we're like, oh, why are we feeling like this? And we're looking for causes, or we're trying to work out the best way to get rid of it. And that really kicks off its own cycle that maintains that panic. So it's really, really key to try and circumvent that by first getting into the body and doing some of those grounding things. The other thing that I explore a lot with my clients is that racing heart feeling. You know, it's so common when we're feeling anxious, but it's so strong. And you know, for some people, it really feels like you're having a heart attack or your chest is really tight and there's something else going on. And so everything in our body is wired up to be like, well, focus on this. You know, something really bad could be happening. And we worry because we can feel our heart rate so much that if we do any activity, it's going to make things worse. Completely intuitive, but actually, it's probably going to be the opposite. So, experimenting with some gentle movement, you don't have to run straight into, you know, high intensity exercise. But whereas you might, if you get it, for example, first thing in the morning and you've got that racing heart, you might sit there for a while monitoring your heart, what it means, scared to move, maybe. I gently encourage people to get out of bed and see how it feels to just do some gentle movement, you know, using the breath as an anchor and trying your best to adjust your focus of attention outside of the body in that case and see what happens. Because we know that symptom monitoring and really getting over focused on what's happening in the body that's uncomfortable can cause a feedback loop where our brains really alerted to what's going on in our body, and it causes more of that threat signaling, and then you know the symptoms maintain. And if we can just experiment with what happens if we move our attention away, having grounded ourselves, then we usually find that things come back to some sort of equilibrium again.
Yeah, that's really, really useful because you're right. It probably doesn't feel like the first thing you're going to think to do. If you've got a racing heart, you might think, oh, yeah, I'm not going to break a sweat and start doing exercise. But exactly, I think stretching, moving, breathing, dancing, running, even singing. I'm someone who I love to sing. And obviously, singing, we know, impacts our breath because often you're inhaling and exhaling and the resonance in your chest. So I think, regardless of whether you think you're a good singer or not, maybe have a little sing in the shower in the morning and see how that impacts your breathing. And you mentioned then straight away, you said about the connection, the mind, the body, the connection. And this is what I love about your work and your posts online, as I said at the start, between, you know, some people just they're talking about the physical body, other people are talking about mental health and mind, but that connection I think is really overlooked and really important. So I've got quite a big question, I suppose, and topic for you, because it's something that I've read about before quite a long time ago about visualization, and it was talking specifically about healing the body and talking about how the thoughts that we think, how much that actually can impact our physiology. So, for example, if you went into an MRI scanner and someone was scanning the brain and asking you to visualize a really juicy apple, and they ask you to visualize biting into the apple, and there's no apple there, but just by thinking about it, the parts of the brain that would, I suppose, activate saliva or taste or scent, those parts of the brain light up. So it's a really powerful thing to say, okay, if that's happening, what happens when you think positive things about your body, about healing your body, and whether that's a physical condition, a mental condition. But of course, I am not an expert, and I feel like the last thing I want to do is say to people, oh, you know, if you have a health condition, just think yourself better, because of course that's, you know, careless and dangerous. But my question is, I suppose, how impactful would you say our thoughts are when it comes to the nervous system, the physical body, and potentially healing the body?
Yeah, again, and you mentioned it there, you know, how easy it is when we're discussing this kind of topic for it to be interpreted. In fact, I was talking with a client about this, exploring the mind-body connection and the importance of thoughts and what's happening in our body. That can make us think, you know, if my mind has a potentially positive impact on my body, equally then does it have a really negative impact on my body? And then if I'm thinking these negative thoughts, is that going to have a hugely detrimental impact on my health? So I want to set out the scene to begin with, which is there's so many different ways that we think, right? And it's not that every discrete thought that we have has a footprint in our biology. And it's not that when we have thoughts, just by virtue of having a negative thought about our health, that's not going to impact on our health. So we definitely don't need to be micromanaging every thought that we have. We could have like 100 negative thoughts pop into our head, and that's not going to have any impact whatsoever. But what I think is helpful is making the distinction between two kind of cognitive processes. So one is a more heuristic type of thought that we are having subconsciously. So if I was going to make a cup of tea, I'd open the cupboard, I'd get out the tea bag, I'd put it in my cup and I'd do the whole thing. And I wouldn't really have had to engage anything intentional in my brain. I'm still having thoughts, but I'm probably not having very many active thoughts about the tea making process. And I'm having probably quite passive thoughts about other things. And none of that's really conscious. If I get to the cupboard and the tea bags aren't there, and then suddenly I have to switch into more intentional thinking, then that kind of thinking is conscious, right? And then I've got some opportunity to intervene. So why this is important is we have between 50,000 and 70,000 thoughts per day. And the ones that we generally pay attention to are the ones that are threatening or tell us that we've got something to do. We might have loads of neutral thoughts, you know, random songs that pop into our head, random memories, random reflections on something that we'll just completely zone out. But because our whole nervous system is wired up to detect threat, those thoughts pop to the top of our head. And never more so than when we're ill or, you know, something that we want to do is being threatened, then those thoughts get prioritized. And those thoughts aren't harmful just by virtue of having them. But if we engage in thinking about them all of the time, and if we're making a lot of negative predictions based on them, and if we're modifying our behavior based on them, and if our mood state's constantly being altered by them, that's more likely to have an impact on our physiology and what happens, you know, directly based on, you know, the thought processes potentially, but also indirectly through how we modify our behavior. So the comforting thing here, right, is that if we notice that we're having these negative thoughts and we're bringing some of that thought stream conscious, A, just by virtue of doing that, we've got a bit more space and potential room for seeing that as a thought rather than a fact. And then that creates a bit more flexibility and it's less scary to our brain. But B, then we create more potential choice of how we want to respond to that. And, you know, to use an extreme example for people with OCD, for example, what happens in OCD is people have these thoughts that are really scary and urgent and they feel they need to act on them. And that creates a lot of anxiety. And then there's a lot of engaging with that thought, you know, both behaviorally with compulsions, but also internally, like trying to counteract it or, you know, convince yourself that that's not the case. And the principle that we use in OCD is the same principles here is actually you take all the power out of that thought by acknowledging it and deciding to do something else, you know, and not give it its dues that it's going to happen. So I guess that's a long preface to your question, but it's just really important, I suppose, to understand that thoughts in themselves aren't that powerful if we're, you know, acknowledging them and noticing them. But if they're just filling our mental landscape with all of these kind of negative predictions that we're not, you know, we're just passively having, then that's probably going to impact on our physiology in lots of different ways, right? By the emotions that they stir up in us, that then have an impact on our biochemistry and our nervous system, by the kind of power of nocebo and placebo expectations changing, you know, those processes in our body. But the simple antidote is recognizing, and then we can work with that.
Yeah, well, it's funny you mentioned placebo, because that's what I was thinking about when you were talking, and that difference between the passive thoughts, the thousands and thousands of thoughts that we don't really even notice, versus the intentional, conscious, I'm focused on this, I'm thinking about this. And that really made me think about the placebo effect. And, you know, we know that in clinical trials, when people are given, you know, some people might be given a pill that's got nothing in it, and some, or just sugar or something, and others might be given a pill that tells them, okay, this is going to do X, Y, and Z. And they study the two groups, and they know that just by being given something and told this is going to, for example, give you more energy, make you run faster, you know, perform better, then the person steps out and goes for their run and they ran faster and they feel better and they go, oh my gosh, it's because I had that, you know, sports drink or that sports performance, when actually they were given water. So we know the power of placebo, the power of the mind. And I think that it's, again, a positive thing. Of course there is, you know, you always have to think about, well, if that's the case, yes, can I think myself ill? But also how empowering and exciting to think, I can think myself well. I can, you know, focus intentionally on things that are going to, even because what comes after thoughts? Words. And what comes after words? Actions, behaviors. And we know that our words have power. Our actions and our behaviors definitely do. The decisions that we make. If we can trace that back to a thought that says, for example, oh, I'm lazy, I'm tired, I'm exhausted, then what actions are going to follow those thoughts? Because if you're lazy and you're exhausted and you're tired and fed up, are you going to choose actions that are going to boost and support your physiology? So that's something that I think when I think about these topics and why I was keen to talk to someone like yourself is to understand, I think I, from my perspective, I suppose I'm not necessarily looking at, okay, the neurochemical reaction, but I know that there's something more than just a feeling going on. And that's what I suppose I want to share with people here is that, okay, what that example I just gave is like, okay, if I'm thinking I'm lazy, I'm tired, I'm exhausted, I'm fed up, I'm stressed, are the words that I use and the actions that follow those thoughts going to help me? Are they going to make my life better? And so to flip that around, what could people start to, I think chronic stress is obviously something I wanted to talk to you about. That's a word that people say, isn't it? I say, I'm so stressed out, I'm overwhelmed, I'm stressed, I'm stressed, I'm stressed. They say it a lot. And so I guess maybe we could dive into a bit of that and what the, firstly, stress is something that is a part of life. You know, we can't mm-hmm. eliminate it or diminish it. It's a part of life. But I think maybe if you could, yeah, explain to us, I suppose, the difference between stress, which we can manage and which we should expect in life, and chronic stress and what that does to the body.
Yeah, so like you say, stress is just a part of life and it's not bad. Our bodies are made to deal with stress, respond to it, and come back down to an equilibrium, which I guess in the literature is called homeostasis, so where everything's balanced out. You know, our hormones, our immune system can be balanced and responsive. The balance of kind of neurotransmitters, all of that. All of these systems are nicely balanced out, and then they can peak when we need them to, and then they can come back down. So stress, acute stress, isn't bad. Repeated stress isn't even bad. But it's when stress perseveres and there's no let up that it changes how the body responds to it, and we then are less able to have that adaptive response to stress because either the peaks are too many and there's less reprieve in between them, or our body starts to generalize, and rather than after the peak happened it comes down, it kind of stays activated and we're in this state of hypervigilance. And there's also the possibility that what can happen is that, you know, our body gets completely, and I think, you know, that's probably where the term burnout comes from. It gets burnt out. So all of the resources that we had physiologically to deal with that stress, is they're no longer there. They've been depleted. So we're kind of underactive and we're not able to get that activation that we need to respond to these different things. And there's so many different ways that chronic stress can be experienced, and so many different things that can influence it, from a consistently stressful, demanding job where we don't feel that we've got the capacity to meet all of the demands, because loads of people have stressful and demanding jobs, but that doesn't cause them chronic stress. But the distinction seems to be, from the literature and the research, if you feel like you've got the capacity and the ability to cope with these things, then it's not quite so stressful. Our body will still respond with the stress response here and there, but it's not going to remain activated and get us really depleted. And of course, like, there's environmental stresses, like if you've got a really stressful home environment, if there's lots of environmental noise in London, you know, flats aren't very good soundproofing, they can be really difficult things with noisy neighbors. So many things can feed into the potential for becoming chronically stressed, including of course health conditions. One thing that I make the distinction of when I'm working with people is, again, we don't need to avoid stress in order to avoid chronic stress. In fact, you know, we can be in quite stressful environments and not experience a chronic stress reaction in our body. What we need to do, though, is make sure that we have enough moments to offer replenishment and reprieve. So, you know, I mean, this
Recovery,
is a very
I feel like
simplistic.
my when you say reprieve, I'm thinking as a maybe it's the athlete mindset of mine, which is like, okay, when you train, you have to recover. When you compete, you have to recover. And I often say that to people with stress. It's like exactly what you said. So moments of stress, moments, peaks and troughs. Imagine the moment of stress is the competition day or the training, but you can't compete every single day, or you can't train every single day. So the moment of rest and recovery and reprise, I think for a lot of people in the modern world, they might work and work and work and work, and they might manage lots of different things, and maybe it's commitments and kids and relationships, all of these things. And then they think that a 2 week holiday once a year in the summer is their moment to reprieve, to rest, to recover. They go to a retreat and they go, okay, I'm going to go to a retreat. And then the rest, it doesn't work, you know, it doesn't work. So if we're hyper-stimulated all the time, if we are feeling okay, I can kind of manage this stress, but actually sometimes people say they can manage the stress because they're like, yeah, I'm coping with it. A lot of people can function with the stress, but it doesn't mean it's not impacting the body. It doesn't mean, for example, if people are, you know, reliant on coffee to feel awake in the morning, or if they sleep all night yet wake up feeling exhausted, or if they have gut irritation and bloating, or if they have skin breakouts, or if their hair's falling out, you know, like these kind of things where they're like, oh, I can cope with my stress. And it's like, really? Because you might think you can. And I'm not judging people, because I've definitely had those experiences myself where I've been like, it's fine, I'm fine. And you're like, you look like you need to go to bed. So yeah, so I think right, I guess it's really helpful. We are trying to make people understand that stress isn't bad. It's not all bad. We have moments of stress, and stress doesn't cause chronic stress, as long as, I suppose, we create these, yeah, buffers, these barriers, these boundaries, these times for rest and recovery. And what could some of those things be? Because it's not just sleep, is it, that can help us to rest and our nervous systems to rest.
No, absolutely not. I've just finished a workbook actually about this exact topic, and one of the principles that I talk about is that we're not we don't I think we're socialized to boom bust because of exactly that. You know, you work for 3 months or 4 months or whatever it's going to be, and then you have like a 2 week holiday, and then you go back and you do a big work period, and then you'll get Christmas off. And that is a really like boom bust thing. Keep going until you get this period of rest, and then you don't have to do anything work wise. I mean, you still probably have to do lots around Christmas. But it's not really terribly helpful to maintain that bodily equilibrium. And even if you think of the working week, you know, we chunk everything into the week, and then the weekend we're meant to just relax. But for lots of us, you know, we might be wired by the weekend because we've been thinking about work all week, and then you've got 2 days, and then you're thinking of, you know, the Monday horrors kind of thing for a lot of people. So one of the key principles is trying to get into the habit of those mini moments of rest and reprieve throughout every single day. And that doesn't have to be big chunks of time. So you could be having a full working day. It could even be, you know, a 10-hour working day, but you could have 10 opportunities to get a bit of reprieve. And that could be from little things like having a 3-minute breather to getting up from your desk and having a bit of a stretch. Those small things really do stack up. If you think about the alternative as just being sat sedentary at your desk the entire time, rushing lunch and doing emails at the same time, as opposed to having a bit of a slowed lunch, getting up from your desk an hour later, coming to sit down, you're not going to lose lots of productive time. And actually, you probably find you're more productive by adopting this kind of thing. So what I divided up in my workbook is trying to break down different types of rest as well. There could be physical rest when you're feeling physically depleted, whether that's because you've got symptoms or you've been training a lot physically. And then, of course, your body needs to rest. So your rest is going to be physical, you know, backing off doing activity maybe, or doing slower activity. Then there's going to be mental rest. So if you've been using your brain a lot and having to do lots of meetings and do lots of deadlines and learning or whatever, you've reduced your cognitive capacity. So actually doing something physical might be quite restful for your overall body and mind, because you're getting out of that cognitive zone and you're getting more in your body. So you can kind of share the load. And then I talk about emotional rest and sensory rest. So if you've been really overstimulated all day, doing lots of different things, maybe that's from movement, maybe that's from using your brain, you might just need to be a bit stiller. I think this is the one that people find hardest, actually, just having quiet time. And you don't have to torture yourself with it. Just dip your toe in the water. It could be 5 minutes of just nothing and just seeing how that feels and allowing your body to settle back down to some kind of a baseline in that 5 minutes and then seeing where you go from there, or going on a walk without, headphones in, or, whatever it might be. And then emotional rest, I suppose, is when there's been a lot of emotional load. Maybe that's you're meeting emotional demands from loved ones, or you've been having a lot of, stress and your own emotional reactions to that. And then you might rely on one of the other kinds of rests to replenish you. So it could be like doing a cognitive task, numbing out from the emotions for a bit by doing a crossword or a Sudoku or, I don't know, something else entirely, watching a film that you can really engage in. And I think what breaking up different types of rest does is it encourages you to check in with actually what's been depleting you and what your body and mind need and how those things can coexist and balance each other out.
Yeah, I really like this. I like this, the different types of rest, sensory rest, emotional rest, physical rest. It makes sense because, as we know, sometimes you can rest the physical body by laying on the couch or by sleeping, and the mind can still feel drained, or you can be emotionally depleted. And the sensory one, I think, is for the modern world, I think, is the biggest challenge. I think people have sensory overload 24 hours a day, and then they never have sensory rest. The only time they're not looking at a screen is when they're asleep. So I think sensory rest is a big one. And I just really like the idea of actually thinking about not saying, okay, I suppose putting the focus on why do I need this rest? So why do I need sensory rest? Oh, because of this. Or when you just gave those examples, if you've been doing a lot of work on a screen, processing, thinking, problem solving, then why do you need that kind of rest? And maybe the same when it comes to emotional rest. Why do I need that kind of rest? What's been going on for the last few months in my life? So I really like this, and I hope that people will take that and kind of reflect actually after this episode and think, what kind of rest do you need? Because the key thing for me, as the listeners of the show, if they hear it every week, they'll hear me say, is about, we all want to feel good. We all know how good it feels to feel good. We all want to have the energy when we wake up in the morning to pursue our goals, to, never mind feeling motivated. If you're exhausted, if you're depleted, it doesn't matter about motivation. You can't achieve the things you want to do, whether it's your personal goals, your professional goals, writing a book, running a marathon, raising your kids. You can't do it if you don't rest, if you don't recover, if you are burnt out and overwhelmed and exhausted. So I really want people to, take some parts of this conversation and think about how they can restore their own energy, how they can restore their nervous systems, how they can manage stress, not eradicate it, but manage it in a way that's going to empower people to feel excited. Like I said, it's the end of the year. Think back over the year and think about, how's my whole year been? Because a year goes so quickly, and I think often we forget the things that we've done. I certainly do. I had a conversation with someone this week and I said, oh yeah, gosh, in January we did this, and then, oh yeah, in April I went to Japan with my son for the first time, and oh yeah, I ran the marathon, and oh, in the summer this happened. And so much can happen in one year, and we don't always take a moment to consider it all, but then to give ourselves time to rest, different kinds of rest. I love this. I think at the end of the year we all need to have, like, I'm going to have sensory rest, I'm going to have emotional rest, I'm going to have physical rest, and start the next year ready to roll, feeling good.
Yeah, I'll send you the link, shall I? Because it's a free booklet, so your listeners might be interested.
Please do. So yes, send the link, we'll put it in the show notes, download that before the end of the year and take that well-deserved rest so we can start next year feeling great. I know I'm a bit, preempting, I know it's only, November, but I feel
it's
like...
It's going quick.
Yeah, it does go quick. And it's interesting when you said about Christmas break, because for some people, Christmas break is maybe restful, but for so many, I think there's a pressure on it, there's a busyness, there's events, there's family to visit, and sometimes that can be stressful, let's be honest. Kids are off school, there's the pressure of doing activities and all the things. I feel lucky to have a busy, colourful, wonderful home life, but it's busy. There's going to be loads of people in and out of this house through Christmas, and I think, to be honest, Christmas is, it's not that restful, I'll be honest. I feel like I have to, I'm going to be saving some energy now for that period.
Yeah. store it up. Yeah, I can relate to that.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Dr. Sula, I have really, really enjoyed this conversation. I'm sure the listeners have too. And of course, because it's Power Hour, I have to ask you and would love to hear about the first hour of your day, what you typically do with that hour. How do you spend your Power Hour?
The first thing that I do in the morning is I tend to read at the moment, actually, which has been a really nice, gentle habit. It's only like 8 pages because I'm not one of these early risers with loads of time before I need to start things, but enough time just to read like 8 pages. And then I'm not a run out of bed enthusiastic to start the day, but I am kind of optimistic for the day. So I then go make breakfast, take my dog out, sit on the couch, and then I will set up my day in my journal and try and kind of time block and get an idea about how things are going to go. And I'm really trying to get back into meditating, which I think is funny because, you know, it's the first thing to drop off when you're busy, but it's the thing that you arguably need to do the most. So that's generally how it starts. And then I'll start seeing my clients soon after.
That sounds nice. That sounds restful. And in fact, you made me think I just ordered a new book. It's a poetry book that I have been reading in the morning. So I move in the morning, but I've been having, I bought this book to read with my coffee in the morning. And so when you said that you're reading in the morning, I mean, to be honest, if you read 8 pages, because it's very, I've got the book here in front of me, I'm going to tell you the title. It's called Let the Light Pour In, Morning Poems by Lem Sisse. So if
somebody's told me about this already, I need to get it.
Yeah, it's really great. It's basically very short. So each of his poems is 4 lines and it's about the morning, and it's really simple and really beautiful. And I've just been, you know, you can just open the book on any page, I suppose. And I've been doing that with my coffee in the morning, and it's so beautiful, especially because I'm someone who in the winter months, when it's dark in the morning and I have to go out with a head torch, an actual head torch, to do my run, because where I live, there's no street lights and it's really dark in the morning. You can't even see the ground. So I have to wear a head torch. I have to wear gloves. I really am like, I'm not one of these morning runners. It's like, yes, embrace the cold. I hate the cold. So then when I come back and I have my nice coffee and the sun's coming in, Let the Light Pour In, Morning Poems. It's such a beautiful thing that gorgeous. I'm enjoying right now. Yeah. So I wanted to share that with you. Yeah. And then, yeah, get a copy. Let me know if you like it.
I am. I'm going to. Yeah, thank you.
Fab. And thank you so much for joining us. As always, I really appreciate the listens, the shares, everyone who kindly recommends the show, rates and reviews. If you haven't already, please do that. That's how we get to reach more people and get more wonderful guests like Dr. Sula. And I will be back next week with another episode. Thank you. See ya.
Thank you.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.